Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Less of a Cis podcast. My name is Zara Gonzalez-Wong, and I'm the author of A New Kind of Wild. Today, I'm joined by Lakin Zaya Kemp, Mia Garcia, Noni Ramos. And today on this episode of Ask a Musa, we'll be talking about how long it takes to write a novel, how you know when a project is finished, how you find an illustrator for your picture book, and what the best way is to market your book. Lakin, can you start us off by introducing yourself and telling us a little about your book?
Yeah, thank you. So as introduced, my name is Lakin Zaya Kemp, and my debut novel, Somewhere Between Bitter and Sweet, comes out from Little Brown on April 6th. It's a foodie romance that really centers around the main character, Pen, and her often fraught relationship with her father. She's keeping a big secret from him, and once it's revealed, he fires her from the family restaurant, which is the place she loves most in the world. But on her last day, she has an intense meet cute with the new hire, Xander, in the employee bathroom, and sparks fly immediately. And we get to see them go on lots of foodie dates together that will definitely make your mouth water. Again, it's out April 6th. So as of this recording, that's in just a few months. And I've got swag for those who pre-order. So definitely check out my website if you're interested in learning more about all the goodies that are up for grabs.
Hi, all. I am Mia Garcia. I am the author of The Resolutions, telling you to pre-order Lakin's book and Noni's book and order Sarah's book. The Resolutions is a YA Latinx contemporary breakfast club style book about four Puerto Rican teens doing New Year's resolutions for each other, and then the repercussions of those resolutions as they develop throughout the year. So heartbreak, new love, and a whole lot of drama. And that is out now.
Hi, I'm Nonica Ramos, and I am the author of the YA book, The Disturbance Dictionary, and the forthcoming picture book, Your Mama, which Versify is releasing April 6th this year. Your Mama is a sweet twist on the age-old Yo Mama joke, celebrating fierce moms everywhere. Recently just received a school library journal star, and it is a book that honors the love, hard work, and dedication of mamas everywhere.
Hello, I am Zara Gonzalez-Wong again, and I write and illustrate picture books. My debut author illustrator book, A New Kind of Wild, came out in April of 2020. It's about the magic of friendship and all the different ways we make a new place feel like home. It's a real special book for me because it was inspired by my dad and his story of moving to New York from Puerto Rico when he was a kid. I also have a book coming out this October called Mi Casa Es Mi Home, written by Loren Sala, and I did the illustrations for it, and it comes out with Candlewick on October 12th. Okay, on to the questions.
Hello, my name is Handy, and thank you for the opportunity because I do have a question. I already have a book. I already wrote a book, but I have no idea how to find an illustrator, especially an illustrator that is sensitive to the book content, because my book is based on the town that I was born in, Mexico. So I really want to find an illustrator that can relate to that, so that culture is reflected in the drawings and the pictures. So I would really appreciate if you can give me some guidance. Thank you.
So I recently sold two picture books last summer, and they are my first picture books. The good news is that when you pursue traditional publishing with a picture book manuscript, the publisher will be the one finding the illustrator, most likely. And this goes for cover art for middle grade or young adult books as well. So for example, for the cover of my debut novel, I really pushed for a Latinx illustrator, and the initial round of options from the sales team included some Latinx illustrators, but even though I was providing feedback, it was essentially the sales team who was whittling down the list, and ultimately they chose not to go with one of the Latinx illustrators on that list. So I was a little bummed about that, I'll be honest, but then late in the process, they shared some work from a Black illustrator, Poppy Magda, and her work was so stunning, so that's who we all agreed to go with. And I was really happy that they'd chosen a woman of color to render these characters because she did such a phenomenal job. But when I sold two picture books to Little Brown last summer, my editor was really adamant about having a Latinx illustrator do the illustrations. And I think even more so because we hadn't been able to make that work for the cover art for my debut novel. And in fact, they're currently discussing pushing the release date of my picture book because some of the illustrators they wanted to approach are already booked. But initially, I was asked if there were any Latinx illustrators I would like them to consider. And I came up with a short list and shared it with my editor via email. So your editor may do the same and ask for input at some point in the process. And this is your opportunity to express your preference for an illustrator that shares your identity or shares the identity of the characters in the book. You might even express this before the deal is even made when you're on the phone with your editor so they know how important this is to you. But there will be opportunities for you to share your feelings about this at some point in the process. And if for some reason that opportunity never arrives, definitely express that to your agent that you'd like some input on this aspect of the book's production. And if you want to curate a list ahead of time, you can start by checking out the Las Musas website. We have some Musas who are illustrators, but we also have many Musas who have written picture books. And if any of the illustrations in those books catch your eye, jot down who the illustrator is so you can share their name with your editor later. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that just because an illustrator is Latinx or shares your identity in some way, that doesn't guarantee that you're going to get the depiction of your characters that's in your head. I remember that there was one particular Latinx illustrator on the publisher's list, and when I went to check out their Instagram and their portfolio, I would say something like 90% of their illustrations of people were of white people. And even the few people of color that they drew had very Eurocentric features and very light skin. This told me so much about what that illustrator believes is beautiful and the standard of beauty that they tend to adhere to in their work. And someone whose work reinforces whiteness as being superior is just not someone I want to be collaborating with. So in our last Ask a Musa episode, Adriana Hernandez Bergstrom, who is a fellow Musa and illustrator, talked about the need for body diversity, diversity in skin tones, and diversity in ethnicity in illustrations. And this is something to keep in mind as you're curating your list of illustrators or evaluating the list of illustrators your publisher gives you. Do they illustrate a variety of ethnicities? And within those ethnic or cultural groups, is there a variety of different body sizes and skin tones? Picture books are some of the first tools that children have for understanding the world around them. And so we want the illustrations in these books to mirror the real world and how big and beautiful and diverse it actually is. So those are really great things to keep in mind when you and your editor and your sales team are collaborating on this part of the process.
I think it's technically my turn, but I actually don't know if I have anything to add to that. That was like super comprehensive. I think the most thing I had was like, if it's something that's really important to you, and it clearly is, then you need to have those conversations with your editor and your agent, who is your ally in the whole process. I'm still in the submission process for my picture book, but it is something that I, when speaking to editors, I do have that conversation, because I know there are Latinx illustrators. I would note that Twitter is actually a really good place for finding illustrators who are putting out their portfolio and samples of their projects, so that, as Lakin said, you can have a list to refer to when you are going out with your project, or when a project has been picked up and your editor is like, do you have anybody in mind? And you have like, here's a list of things, of illustrators that I love their work and so on. But I have nothing else to add. You did such a great job.
I think it's so important that we're all coming to this topic with these perspectives. You know, Mia, you as somebody who has several works, but is now in the submissions process again, which is completely normal. And is part of the process for us all. We're always submitting, promoting, revising. That's super important to hear your perspective. From my perspective as a YA writer transitioning to PBs, it was quite an education. What I did in my approach when I had offers on the picture book was to see how much the publisher valued my feedback. When I had discussions with Versify, I discussed that I required a BIPOC person for an illustrator. I didn't necessarily specialize specify Latinx, but that was something that we took care of within the first few minutes of the conversation, because the partnership between an illustrator and an author is crucial to the book's success. It's your message, it's your brand, and it's not just your message as far as promotional material, but it's your message as to what you want to communicate to children and what you're trying to nurture in children, which Lakin so beautifully spoke about already. I made sure that these conversations were had before contracts were signed, and they were key in my decisions as to who to sign with. I had beautiful experiences with both Versify and Learner. With Versify, we came to that agreement. With Learner, we came to the agreement where I insisted that I had a Black illustrator. And sometimes when we look for illustrators, there are extraordinary Latinx illustrators, for example. But sometimes we tend to only look for the same ones. And so what I really appreciated was that with both publishers that we explored options of lesser known, people who are on the come up, people who are developing their careers. And so with my picture books, I have two very established people, but I also have somebody who's new on the scene in a sense and is beginning to establish her picture book career with Hair Stories. So I really appreciated the idea that part of what I'm doing and in developing my career is to help to develop the career of other people in the industry. We're talking all about helping each other up, and we're not helping each other because we're not all talented. We're helping each other because we're in a volatile industry and we need each other. I agree with everyone's suggestions. We as in the publishers and I looked for artists and illustrators on Instagram and on Twitter. Instagram is a huge resource. If you look on childrensillustrators.com on Instagram, you'll get a wide array of possibilities. Just to kind of add some additional suggestions, I also agree with Twitter. And remember, sometimes there are artists who are not quite illustrators, but their art is phenomenal and they are drawing children. And so exploring that with basic search words in Google, Instagram, and Twitter will get you to that point. I did want to agree with the fact that we have to understand that even if you get a Latinx illustrator, for example, for me, I had to do an extensive amount of research, and that included Mia in making sure that the representation of Puerto Rican culture was accurate, especially when it came for me to things like not having grown up on the island and making mistakes in some of my representations, or in my case, as growing up as a Bronx Puerto Rican, that's a very unique experience. And my illustrator had to work very closely because she's Colombian. And that is night and day. And I think what I would caution anybody in exploring is to say, you need to communicate with your publisher that because you have, if you're a Black author and you have a Black illustrator, it still means you have to have crucial conversations, because Black experiences are not monolithic. The assumption is always that Black experiences are based in the city. There are suburban BIPOC people, you know? Assumption is if it's a Puerto Rican and a Colombian, we're gonna instantly understand each other and know how to depict that. And that is 100% not the case. It's absurd. And so that's a conversation that I would say to everybody out there needs to continue throughout the entire process with each and every part of the spread all the time. And please expect that corrections are going to have to be made. So establishing a positive relationship is important, because you might correct each other in that dialogue, and that will result in complete changes in representations of your cover and of particular spreads that can have a profound effect in your career. Because when people read your book and see things that are not authentic, that's not representing them, and they don't feel like they're being seen, especially in a industry that's very whitewashed. The last thing I want to bring up in adding to what Lakin said about diversity is LGBTQ representation. One of the most important things to me when I'm publishing my books, and this is the case that I've had to advocate for in all my books, even if your book isn't about explaining what LGBTQIA is, it should be represented in some way or fashion in every book. That's how I feel. There are so many picture books out there with city scenes where people are walking around. Opportunities. There should be couples represented who are of different body types, shapes, religions, spiritualities, because that's the world that we actually live in. And so while, for example, Beauty Woke isn't a book about an LGBT pride parade, LGBTQ Puerto Ricans are repped. and LGBTQ people are repped in Hair Story, where I had to work with the illustrator and to say the two women in the book are not just friends, and that needs to be shown in the book, and they need to touch each other and maybe hold hands. That's natural and normal and beautiful and age appropriate. So that's my kind of addition to Lakin's beautiful treatise.
Wow. So that's a lot of really good stuff. And here I am bringing up the end. And I think that I can add a little bit of extra stuff because I am the only illustrator in this group. And while I agree with everything that everybody said, I do think that there's some interesting things coming from the perspective of an illustrator. And I think that as much as we write from our background and from our perspective on things, the thing about writing picture books and the thing about selling picture books is that you are not the sole owner of the book. When you sell a manuscript, when you sell a picture book, you are selling it to the publisher, and then you are partnering with an illustrator. And that illustrator is a full partner in the process of creating the art for the book. You wrote the words, they do the pictures. And yes, obviously, illustrators want to be culturally sensitive, and we want to make sure that everything is the way, you know, that is shown in a way that is going to portray everybody in the best light. But unless your picture book specifically calls out your culture and your background, if the illustrator is not from that culture or background and it's not pertinent to the story, the illustrator and potentially the publisher may not be looking at those things as something that's important to the book. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't look for an illustrator that isn't of the same background. I certainly think that you absolutely, if you're Puerto Rican and you want to have a Puerto Rican illustrator illustrate it, of course, you should absolutely suggest that to your editor, suggest that to your publisher, negotiate for that in your contract, like Noni was saying. But I think that it's also good to be open to what other cultures and other people can bring, because if, like, once your vision of the book is out there, you're essentially sharing that vision with an illustrator. So, you know, I'm Puerto Rican, but I was born here, not on the island. I was born in Minnesota, so like far away from New York. My perspective on what being Puerto Rican is very different than Mia's or than Noni's, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's less valid. So, like, for example, if there was a book where, you know, it's just a nice story, there's not necessarily any cultural aspects in it, you want somebody who can be culturally sensitive, who's going to bring, like, maybe BIPOC or Latinx characters into the book. Well, I would illustrate a book with BIPOC characters, with Latinx characters, because that's just what I feel is important. And it would have some Puerto Rican flair because that is who I am. But if I was, you know, Mexican and I brought some Mexican flair to the book, just because you're Puerto Rican, and I'm using Puerto Rican as an example because I am and three, you know, three of us are, doesn't necessarily mean that book is any less valid because the person who's illustrating it comes from a different culture. Now, I think if there are things, like especially in Noni's book, Your Mama, like that just is a very specific thing. And I can understand 100% advocating for a Black illustrator for, you know, because there's a cultural component to that like I wouldn't get, you know, because I'm not Black. That Your Mama culture is not part of something that I grew up in, and I wouldn't feel comfortable illustrating something like that. But if it's something else, if it's something like, for example, I just illustrated a book about home and family, and home and family to me 100% has Puerto Rican culture, Puerto Rican things. Like the things that are in my kitchen are not necessarily the same things that are going to be in a non-Puerto Rican's kitchen. But those are important to me. And I put those things into the book because those cultural aspects of things are important to me. But if somebody who was Colombian illustrated that book and they put those things, you know, their cultural touch points into the book, I don't think that that would be wrong. It just would be a different thing. So I think this is a really long way of saying, I think we have to be open to other, to the illustrator bringing their vision to the book as well, as long as the manuscript itself doesn't 100% need to be your vision. That was a little bit of a ramble, but the other thing that I wanted to say was, if you want to find places to find great illustrators that are people of color, Twitter, Instagram, there are hashtags like Drawing While Black, Latinx Create, Latinx Art. There are directories like Women Who Draw, where you can filter by religion, gender expression, nationality, you know, all sorts of things. So it really lets you have some way of granularly sorting things. And these are people that have submitted themselves. So they're putting themselves into whatever buckets that they identify with. So I really think that those places are really great places to look. And I do think that it's incredibly important to have these conversations with your publisher, with your editor, with your agent, you know, maybe even before you go out on submission, because if these are the things that are really important to you, you want to make sure that your agent knows that these are the things that are really important to you. And you want to make sure that your agent is going to advocate for you when you're in talks to sell your manuscript, because you want to make sure that your book is going to go somewhere where people are going to be sensitive to the things that are really important for you.
I wanted to add on and cheer on what Zara said. The illustrator is not there to check off boxes for you. That it is a delicate balance. I could never have envisioned what Jackie Alcantara did with Your Mama. I could never have told her or communicated to her or dictated to her. That is her art form. And you want the magic of these illustrators taking it far beyond your wildest dreams. It's just a beautiful balance and symbiosis and exchange, that's all. And so I think what we're all saying is communicate, talk, hear perspectives. And that's where you're gonna get, for the most part, and for most of us, we're describing a positive experience. Art is always frustrating, but it's always magical too.
How long does it take to write a novel?
So I have a preferred pace of about 8 months to draft a new novel. And then I have a publishing pace of about 6 months to draft a new novel. And really the difference between the two is just whether or not that book is contracted yet. So if I'm starting a project that no one knows about but me, I'll take a little bit more time and really get to know the characters before I move on to revising. And this is what I was able to do with my first middle grade novel. That book wasn't under contract. No one was waiting for it. So I was able to spend that time. On the flip side, though, for my second YA book with Little Brown, I only had 6 months to draft it and do at least one revision on my own before it was due to my editor. So a much tighter schedule, which I did not enjoy. And it actually has me rethinking whether or not I want to continue with two book contracts, because I just haven't had the time I need with this second book. And it's really honestly been stressing me out. But yeah, 6 to 8 months, regardless of whether that's a middle grade novel or a young adult novel. And then when it comes to picture books, there is a lot of thinking time, a lot of words and ideas that never actually make it onto the page. So I take a lot of notes in my phone, waiting for things to click. And then when I finally sit down to write, I usually crank out a first draft in a day or two, and then spend a couple of weeks to a month tweaking and revising before sending to my agent.
Yeah, more or less the same. I mean, the resolutions, listen, I've spent 10 years writing this one novel that just like never ends. And I wrote the resolutions, which was under contract. I wrote a first draft in like 3 months because I had to hand it in, had to have that first draft in, that which then got like a 9 to 10 page editorial letter, and I had to rewrite it. So from start to finish, the resolutions was about a year and a half, which included editorial and rewriting and so on. From the first page I wrote to getting the arc in my hands was about a year and a half of work. And compared to that book that I'm eternally writing and never finishing, it's a big difference. I mean, every story requires its own set of time. And I definitely write differently under contract than I do on my own pace, my own language pace. For picture books, the one that is currently on submission, it took me about on and off, I would say like maybe 4 months. I'm looking at Noni because I sent her every draft that I had. And I was like, is this ready? And she's like, no. I was like, dang it. So I did about four months of writing and rewriting before I sent it to my agent, and then spent about another 2 months adjusting to her notes, having, you know, existential crisis about if I'm changing this one sentence here, is the whole story ruined? Because picture books, it's like you have 600 words and all those words are precious. And if you mess with one stanza, how does that ruin the emotional arc of the picture book and so on and so forth? So it really depends, but I also echo the stress of writing something under contract. Like, it is not fun.
It's so impossible to follow up on these brilliant responses. It's stressing me out. I'm going to start off with the stress of what Lakin said. The second book, Mia is frequently in counseling with me over this book. And I will just say that the most key and important thing is to actually let yourself take the time that the book needs. And I know based on the two previous responses, you understand that in context, because there's a big difference between you writing where I am now. Mia is currently commenting on my draft for a novel that I'm hoping at some point will be going on submission. But I think my answer to this when I was preparing was, it takes your entire life to write a novel, and here's why. And I don't want to make people feel stressed, but this is a craft, it really is. And everything that you're working on now is the result of everything you worked on before. So while this particular novel that I feel was ready enough to go to readers like Mia to put comments and to say what I need to work on, and that took a year, it really took the two previous novels. For me personally, with the growth that I went through with the first one, but immensely with the second one, where my second novel really compelled me to reflect for a year and to really spend that time revising a novel 10, 15 times, it's all part of the process. And so I caution everyone to understand you're building a career, you're not building on one book. And then just to get to the specifics, I mean, me and Lakin did perfectly with the nitty gritty, but for me to accelerate, because you do have deadlines, outlines can be bare bones, they can be bullet points, they can be thick, they can be pictorial. Sometimes I draw, map, put stuff on boards to make sure that I'm accountable. I always leave myself questions so that I know that I have a goal in mind, because when we're making novels, we're also creating motifs and themes. And while that sounds totally intimidating, it really is not just a narrative arc as in a plot line, but as Mia said, an emotional arc. And also, what if you're building suspense? That's an incredible skill to have to learn. And that's what I've been trying to do over the past year. And how do you do that? How do you accelerate your craft? Read books that do it extremely well. And I'm going to say it, sometimes you're not going to read the book for pleasure. You're going to read the book to dissect the shit out of it. And you're going to say, this author did this brilliantly right here. How did they do that? And you're going to read that passage several times and figure out the craft of what that brilliant person did before you as a mentor text. And so to make your novel not take 10 years and just the, let's say, well, right now I've got this idea and how long is it going to take? It's absolutely doable in a year if you are reading, if you are pausing. My last thing is to say, when is it done? When I finally gave it to Mia, it wasn't just because a year had passed. It was because I had particular goals that I felt that I had accomplished and reached to the maximum ability by myself. Because that was, and I needed to be in isolation. And I thought, I'm ready to be out of isolation. And then I waited and I let the manuscript breathe, because you can't see things the same when you look at the manuscript constantly. And that is especially true of a picture book, by the way. You will never see what needs to be fixed and what you're clinging to, because we all cling to things. And then we realize later that wasn't essential to the manuscript. It really wasn't. And I know I'm definitely guilty of this. I think, wow, that sounds extraordinary. My voice is so fabulous. And then you're like, you said the same thing four times in a row in a 600-page manuscript. you know, cut that out. But you don't see it when you first do it because you're too busy reveling in your fabulousness to realize what you're going to be told by your beta readers and what you're going to be told by your editor. And what kids don't need to read, they don't need to read your redundancy and your ego. So, you know, they need to read your message most cleanly polished. So breathing is my biggest thing because it sounds counterintuitive because we want to accelerate. So I'm going to end there. Let your manuscript breathe. Get away from it. When it's ready, give it to other people and then come back. And all of a sudden, you're going to see what needs to be done to get it to that last point. And I still think that can all be done in a year or less.
That was a slight spoiler for the next question, too. Noni, what's up?
So what else can I add? I mean, obviously, writing is super personal. Some people write really fast. Others write really low or really slow. I am on the really, really slow track. It takes me ages and ages to write a book. And I write picture books and they're short. So I've had stories knocking around with me for years. I take them out. I work on them for a while. I get stuck. I put them away. And eventually I come back to them again. And I guess if the question is how long it takes to write a story, then the answer could be an hour, a day, a week, but that's just the first draft. Sometimes the stories come really quickly, but the revisions, those are the things that take a while. A new kind of wild came really quickly to me. It just came right in a hurry. I got it all. But then I revised it for an entire year before my agent and I felt ready to send it out. And then once we sold it, it took another 8 months for it to get into the form that it was in when it was published. So I am very, very slow. And part of that is that I'm very, very slow. Part of it that is that I'm also an illustrator. So with illustrators, when you're submitting books, you're not just submitting the manuscript, you're also submitting a dummy to go along with the manuscript. And so that takes significantly longer than just writing the manuscript. And I say just writing the manuscript as if that's easy, but that's just as hard as doing the drawings for it as well. It's just, I have to do double the work up front and you guys only have to do half of it. I mean, I have friends who can draft a picture book manuscript and the dummy in a couple weeks. I don't know how they do it. I could never do that. I think the quickest that it's ever taken me to draft a story with a dummy is maybe 3 weeks. But that's the first draft. I know there's a ton more work to go after that. So I don't know. I guess my answer is really completely unsatisfying because everyone is different and it takes as long as it takes. And you can't beat yourself up about whether you think you're moving too fast or too slow. If you're working on it, if you're moving forward, then that's all you can do. And it'll take as long as it takes. You can't rush the muse, right?
Can you explain for a second what a dummy is? Because I don't think a lot of people know what that is.
Yeah. And for anybody who doesn't know what a dummy is, I just kind of glossed over that. A dummy is what an illustrator will send their manuscript as. So instead of just words, which is what a manuscript typically is, if you're an illustrator, then you create what's called a dummy, which is essentially taking the manuscript, putting it into pages, and then sketching all of the illustrations that would be in the book. So you're essentially sending a sketched out version of the book. And that is what a dummy book is. So if you're an author and an illustrator, then you would send basically a complete sketch of the book. And I realized I forgot to answer this question, which is how long does it take to illustrate a book? And it takes about 6 months to a year to illustrate a book. It depends, one, on deadlines, and two, in what medium you're working. So if you're working traditionally, you might get a little bit more time from the publisher. If you're working digital, maybe you would be able to do it a little bit shorter. But I think typically what I've gotten from publishers is about 6 months, although when I sold A New Kind of Wild, because it was author and illustrator, and we did all of the writing revisions first, you still have a deadline that's not going to change for when the final things are going to be done or due. So I spent 8 months working on the words, and then I only had about 4 or 5 months left for the illustrations. So sometimes you have to like hurry up and do them as fast as you can and not necessarily have as much time as you would like to, But you just got to make it work because deadlines are deadlines. Although they usually give you a deadline that has a little bit of wiggle room. So not that you should count on that, but it is good to know.
Let me chime in here too. It's something just made me think of that might help people as well. My books, one of them now has back matter that was not originally planned, and that took an extensive amount of work, and I knew nothing about it because I am not a nonfiction writer. So I think one lesson that might be helpful for people, just from my experience, is to envision what your book will look like from beginning to end, including past the illustration pages, and if there were to be back matter. And because I didn't anticipate that, and it changed the trajectory of the timelines of what was required of me, what was due, what got taken out of the book later to make room for it, because we have to also understand with picture books, there is a limited amount of pages. You cannot go past them. So in order to put the back matter in that got required, I had to take out very prized, tender things to my heart. Yes, it was tragic. And what I'm getting out of it is gorgeous and beautiful. But I think, Lakin, you said this earlier with your first cover of your book, you did eventually end up where you wanted to be, but there was a little bit of, oh, you know, that isn't exactly what I thought. So just kind of make sure you ask questions in the beginning about people's visions for glossaries and people's visions for back matter, two things that I didn't consider, especially if you're a Latinx writer and you're going to have Spanish words sprinkled in.
Hi, I'm Merce Garces, and I'm in the Hermanas mentorship program, which is amazing. And I wanted to ask you, how do you know when to stop writing? Like, at what point, or how do you know that your manuscript is done and that you've worked on it as much as you could, and now you need to stop?
And we've been talking a lot about deadlines. So for me, if something is under contract, I have other people like my agent or my editor or other people at the publisher helping me reach certain milestones with a project and hit certain deadlines. And so if I get to that final deadline before copy edits and I feel like the story makes sense, it doesn't leave me with any lingering confusion or questions, and every character has experienced some kind of growth or change, like we've been talking about how important that emotional arc is, then I usually feel comfortable that it's ready. And similarly, when I'm not under contract, I know something is finished when I've taken care of all of the things I just mentioned. And like Nani said earlier, there's nothing else I can do on my own. I've brought the manuscript to a point where I've improved it as much as I possibly can alone. And that's when I know it's ready to either go to my agent or go to a critique partner and be opened up to someone else for feedback.
Just to go off what Lakin said, if you're not making any big structural changes, I think that's a good flag for it can move to another reader. I can't say enough about really finding critique partners that you trust to look at your work. As Noni said, you are really, really close to what you're writing and you cannot see. There comes a point that you can just not see the cracks because I believe there's a psychological sentence that you read that's all garble, but you can read it perfectly because your brain starts filling in the cracks and where the words go and the missing vowels. And that's a little bit like writing when you've read the manuscript like 17 times and you're like, this is perfect. There's nothing left to do. And then the first your critique partner reads it and says, chapter three, there's a huge plot hole. Like, look at this thing. And you're like, wait a minute, I didn't see that. So I can't stress enough to get some critique partners that you trust. And that does take time. That does take trial and error. You're not going to find one straight off the bat. That does take sharing work with people who, not everybody makes a good critique partner. Not everybody can tell you like, hey, this need to fix the structure here. The voice is uneven over here and stuff like that. So it does take some trial and error. Also, you need to realize that as a writer, you're always growing and learning and changing. So it might feel that it's never really ready because we're always actively growing as artists and learning. So sometimes it just takes time to learn to let go, to realize where as it's always been said, you've taken it to the point that you can, where you are as an artist for the moment. And from there, you have to let it go and have somebody else come in and take it to another level or help you see new things.
What you just said just exploded my brain, Mia. It just was so brilliantly put. What can I add here? I think that we have to keep in mind that the process of editing and revising will continue past you submitting it to your agent and past you giving it to your editor. So I can add that. Your vision is going to evolve, hopefully in partnership and community. There's no such thing as a successful book created by one person. It's always created by a team. Any exquisite book that you see, there are a team of people who are, had their hands in what you see and what they created. And most of the time you'll see incredible artists acknowledging those people when they're having their great successes. I love hearing that. Your critique partners may also evolve. Somebody who works for you in a critique process when you're at a certain point in career may not work at a later time. You need to definitely have a mutual respect. Critique groups can be very passionate. I think we kind of see them as these little machines. They're not machines. They are people interacting with your precious baby art. And you're going to, oh, well, this is how you perceived it. And you're going to feel a little bit naked, you know, and a little bit raw sometimes when somebody's looking at what is so close and personal to you. So I think that the ideal is for us to strive for these critique partnerships with that are passionate and that we expect passion and that we hope that the people who are looking at us are trying to get us to what, as Mia was saying, that the next level of the highest level we can get it to. Because the fact is when you've got people like Jason Reynolds talking about how he might have changed a book if he wrote it now, you hear that. This tells you everything you need to know. You're doing the best that you can at the time that you can in a cultural context where you, I guarantee you aren't going to know everything you know the next book, because nobody in a colonized society knows everything. And you don't know everything when you're writing it. What you can do, I would say also, to get your point to as finished and sparkling as possible, is to consider the sensitivity reads. Because I am insensitive to people, 100%. There is no way that I can understand everybody all the time because everybody hasn't had a voice. So how could I possibly know how everybody truly feels? And one of my best examples in my revision process was disability rep. And the way that I initially wrote my disability rep in the book that I have now was very objectionable. And when I did more research and read pieces from people with disabilities saying, this is how I feel in a day of my life, I thought, I wasn't perceiving that at all. I thought I was being sensitive and I was being ignorant. And then I did rewrites, and this is by myself in isolation before I thought, now I'm comfortable enough that whatever criticism I get, it will be with the most dignity that I've gotten this piece to. So I think also the sense of finished, especially in a colonized society, is to also say that you've given your book to people who can say, let me look at that from the perspective that you are not. We should be representing people we are not. That's the planet we're on. But you need those people to say, good. Okay, I feel dignity when I read what you wrote. Or you got this a little bit off here. And let me tell you why. So I guess that's what I would say for my last thing, is that you need the community to make sure that we're giving the story and the people represented the most dignity possible when we go forth.
All of that. All of that. I don't know that I can say add anything really, except that is a project ever really finished? I mean, I don't think that it actually is. I think a project is finished, you know, in quotation marks, when I can't find anything else to do to it to make it better. And then, like everybody was saying, then you send it off to your critique partners, to your agent, to your editor, depending on what stage the project is in. And whether it stays finished depends on what they say to you after they've read it. You know, they may say to you, this is great. It's ready to go out on submission. It's ready to publish. It's ready to go to your agent, whatever. But you never know until you send it out to have other eyes on it, you know, whether those are trusted critique partners, sensitivity readers, people that are outside of your trusted circle at a certain point so that you can get fresh eyes on it. I do think that that is a really, really, really important stage in figuring out whether something is done or not. But I think in general, I just try and revise until I can't see anything else that I can change. And then it's finished until it's not.
Based on your experiences, what have you found to be the most effective marketing techniques?
So I spent many years self-publishing, and whether you're self-publishing or your book is being traditionally published, the best marketing tool at your disposal, in my opinion, is an active and regularly updated newsletter. When you're gaining followers on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, those platforms have all of the control. So for example, when I was self-publishing years ago, it was really easy to get posts in front of people who'd liked my Facebook page. Now you have to pay for that, which means for someone like me who wasn't spending money on Facebook ads or to boost my Facebook posts, the platform is no longer as effective as it once was. And these platforms can make changes like that whenever they want. So your audience on these platforms doesn't truly belong to you. You can't leverage them to their full potential. But a newsletter is a direct line between you and your readers. You don't lose or limit your contact with them unless they unsubscribe. So as soon as you can, I would create a newsletter, even if it's only for family and friends at first. It will grow over time, especially if you're regularly promoting it elsewhere, doing giveaways in exchange for people subscribing. I recently did an art giveaway on Twitter, and people could enter to win by subscribing to my newsletter. But you could also give away a short story or a poem or maybe some character art. There's a lot of stuff you can do to funnel people there. And then once you do have subscribers, be consistent. I try to send out my newsletter every month on or around the first, and have been for almost 2 years. And in the beginning, as you're growing your list, you might not feel very motivated to create a newsletter because not that many people are reading it. But I still recommend doing it for no other reason than just to build up that habit. Get used to whatever schedule you create for yourself so that when people do start signing up more regularly, you're able to deliver content regularly as well. Also, you can archive those old newsletters and still make them accessible on your website for future readers to discover. So for example, if you go to my website at lakeandzeakemp.com and go to the contact page under the newsletter sign up, you'll see a purple button that says newsletter archive. And it might be helpful to look through my old newsletters to see what kinds of content I'm sharing with subscribers. A lot of it reads almost like a blog or diary, and I'm basically recapping things that have been happening on my publishing journey, things I've learned, things I'm grappling with. I also share what I'm reading each month, as well as music I'm listening to. I link to recent blog posts and episodes of both my personal podcast, Author Pep Talks, and the Las Musas podcast. I share video replays from live events that I participated in. So it's mostly about me as a writer, but there's also some personal information in there to help people get to know me a little better. So make sure the content isn't too dry. This is your opportunity to show more about your interests and your personality. So don't be afraid to share those things. And as far as platforms, I use MailChimp, and we recently migrated the Las Musas newsletter over to MailChimp as well, because we found Weebly to be too clunky and just not able to handle what we were wanting to do. There's also Tiny Letter if you want a more minimalist look. I know Squarespace recently integrated a new newsletter option, though there isn't a free version. So there's lots of options out there. You might also go to the websites of some of your favorite authors and subscribe to their newsletters so you can compare the different content being provided to see what resonates most with you and what you think you can replicate, as well as seeing what different platforms they're using and which one you think you like best. But in my opinion, newsletters are so essential because they allow you to share things directly with your audience. Even if that audience is small, it'll eventually grow, and then you'll have this community right at your fingertips to help support your work.
That was some great advice. Although I don't think I'm going to do a newsletter anytime soon. Mostly because the same reason I never kept a blog, where I was just like, why? I don't even want to hear my own voice half the time. So my answer, I'm going to try and not be pessimistic about it. Okay, so here, things that work for one book may not always work for another book for various reasons. Specifically also for what Lakin mentioned is the nature of social media and marketing itself changes so quickly that it's often hard to pinpoint what's working. And it's very, very hard to fight against the algorithms when you are not putting money behind them. And that's basically the point as to why the algorithms change. And while all those new updates happen is for you to spend more money. Same, like if you didn't know, Facebook owns Instagram. So if you're like, I'm wondering why I haven't seen this person in my feed in a while. It's because if you literally are not interacting or commenting with their posts, the algorithm is not going to show them to you unless they're going to spend money on it. Because that's what they want. They want the money. Also in general, it's really not a one for one thing. If 60 people like something that you did on Instagram, on Twitter, 60 people are not going to go and buy your book. It's not as easy as you've liked it to be. There's no direct correlation, which is very frustrating and annoying, particularly if you have a lot of followers, but you're not seeing all those followers going and pre-ordering your book. It's because social media is such as Lakin says, just a difficult thing to work with. And you explained it in such a perfect way. It's their platform that you're on. So they're changing the rules and they're changing how it's being used for their benefit. When marketing the resolutions, I thought of three things, essentially. I wanted to amplify the content of the book in a way that matched the book. So in the resolutions, there was a lot of baking. There was New Year's resolutions. So I did my Instagram posts and my Twitters and all of the social that I did and activities to match like Nora's baking in the book. I did an Instagram stories where I baked through a lot of the recipes of the book. And I did that once a month with beautiful photography and a recipe at the end. And I had that pinned in my highlights. Number two is you really need to think about time and budget that you want to dedicate to something, which keeps it in a very realistic realm and avoids burnout. I probably went a little bit too hard in the resolutions in that first year and like very heavily burned out. So I do like to reiterate that for anybody who's in their debut year is like really think on the time that you want to spend emotionally and physically on things and the budget as well. You know, if you're going to make your own postcards, if you're going to make your own promo and swag, if you're going to do a pre-order the campaign, all of that takes budget, takes time out of your day. So really think about what you have to spend both physically and monetarily as well. Also think about, that is also super helpful to not fall into the, I need to do everything for this book and I need to do it all pre-pub or I need to do it all in the first 2 months or it's all a waste, right? The resolutions came out 2 years ago and I'm still talking about it. I'm still doing blog posts about it and having interviews about it. It is a long marathon for each book. And a lot of times you're writing a new book at the same time, you're promoting another book at another time. So again, think about that time, think about that budget, and think about that energy that you have to sustain throughout the year as well. And then the third one, which is also very important, is having fun and exploring. Social media is always developing new ways of reaching audiences. So like have fun, explore new things. Like maybe you want to try blogging for a little bit or doing longer blog posts or doing Instagram lives with your author friends or a conversation with your illustrator if you have a picture book out. Just make sure that you're having fun. Otherwise, it's really going to also be very taxing emotionally as well. So I'm not the right things.
I was taking notes on the both of you. And also, Lakin, you could be doing the news. You are so perfection in your delivery. There's nothing that you don't say that comes out smooth. So I am entering into the point where I have to consider publicity specifically because my publicity meeting is coming up next week and I have to know what I'm bringing to the table. I understand, or I should communicate, that you do not always have a publicity person at your disposal. I have had both experiences where I've had communication with the publicity department, but not someone that's specifically focused on my book as extensively as is happening with your mama. I think that one of the most important messages that I'm gathering from Lakin and Mia is you have to customize your experience, one, by researching what's going to best work for you and what could be most successful. So for example, with blog posts, you tend to get quite a few requests for those when you are coming out with a book, whether it's a debut or not. And I and many other writers I've spoken to have learned to limit those. Your writing takes an extensive amount of time. When I work on a blog post, I work on it with just as much energy as I do with anything else I write. So that may take me hours, especially because I tend to talk about social justice issues and I use my platforms constantly to promote my agendas, which is equity, equity, equity. So I generally am not writing light pieces. And so a balance of what you're willing to commit to, because the amount of time and energy you're expending for that may be for a wonderful purpose, but then again, where are you left with how much of your intended targeted audience are you reaching? So for me, my point is this: I want to reach educators. I want to reach teachers in schools. I want to get into schools to do school visits. For me, I feel like too much of marketing is sometimes geared, in my opinion, towards adults. And while I need the adults, I 100% need them, because they are, in a sense, these gatekeepers who are going to make invitations, who are going to give you access to students. And that's super important. And we're absolutely all in community. Most importantly, I want to be with the kids. I want to be with the kids. So for my marketing this time, I've put a lot more focus into what school visits look like, especially in a time of a pandemic, where I have to figure out, for example, with my first school visits, how much of that am I going to do live and how much of that I'm going to pre-record so that I can have the most optimal time with the kids once they're in front of me, especially because they don't get to be with me. And with younger children, that's extremely difficult. They need to be near you and pull on your clothes, and they need to ask you questions. I think, you know, customizing your experience, considering how much energy you're giving. If a newsletter is the best way, then that's where not only are you going to think about how much of my target audience am I going to reach and what's the effect on this? What are the analytics of it? You can look at your analytics and see how many people you've reached. You can look at Amazon Central and see where your book rankings have gone. I can see sometimes where that changes depending on what venue I've done, where I'll see a reaction almost right away. I wish that were something you could measure, not in Amazon, but you can use it as a free, currently free tool. But I wanna kind of overarch all of this with community. Things change from minute to minute, and I may find Lakin's advice exactly what I need, even though I'm lazy and I don't wanna do it right now. I don't wanna do it. But I may know she's right, and I may hear that voice in the background. And I listen to Mia's everything, because everything you can possibly listen to with me about publicity is correct. But community is the key, because when I'm navigating forth through all of the things that I do well, I tend to be a good public speaker, or the things I do poorly, I am so bad at Twitter chats, Lakin. I just can't. No matter what happens, I listen to my people and I gather what also works for them. And then I can figure out in the best, most researched, expedient way, what's gonna work for me at the moment. So when I'm in Las Musas, and I'm also in two other groups, it's Soaring 20s is a big shout out here. We're constantly tossing ideas off each other and saying what worked, what led to sales, or what led to school visits, or how did you get to participate in World Read Aloud Day? How does one do that? When you're a newbie writer, you have no freaking idea. I didn't when I started with The Disturbed Girl. I had no idea. I didn't even have an unboxing. There was no launch. I was like, I'm selling books. I wrote a book and it's there if you want to have it. So you learn from people, you get on panels. A big, huge thing in the writing community is to promote your book, to promote your ideas, and to promote your message through festivals, conferences, panels, conventions. That's huge in our industry. And so how do you do that? I find that you're most successful when you're going as a team. I find that I'm most successful when I'm saying, hey, Mia, Lake, and Zara, I'm putting proposals together. Who wants to jump on board with me on this? And we together promote each other, and we believe in each other. And when we're out there most exposed, and we're out there most vulnerable, and we're out there with the work of our heart out there, I know, hey, you know what though? No matter what happens, my people are there behind me. And I hope everybody shows up to the Lakin party and the Mia party and the Zara party and the Nanika party. But sometimes not everybody shows up to all the things. But you know, when you have these communities, your people or your posse are in your corner to amplify you in ways that even go beyond specific marketing techniques, because really it's about the people. And you could have every perfect website, every newsletter, and all of this, but if you don't have people behind you supporting you emotionally, you're not gonna make it. This industry is tough. But if you do, then they can refine you when you haven't made the best marketing decisions or the best decisions about proceeding forward or the best manuscript. Or they can amplify you and say, hey, this is ready. You're ready. Let me make a suggestion. Hey, how about your website have the event page turned on, Nonika? I got from Mia. She's like, your page. You see? So, you know, she's like, that's, do you know that that's not even operating? So my point is us is the answer. And when you make an announcement for a book or Publishers Weekly says, hey, you know, such and such just published a book, people are looking for you immediately to form these groups. I've been asked more times than I can say yes to. And so don't feel like, how do I find the group? They actually are looking, especially with marginalized people, especially with Latinx people, to form these communities because we also still so much need each other. So that would be my advice, is you continue to get great advice through your people.
I think all these ideas are really great. And I especially feel that the community aspect of things is really important. I think that having a community around you that's helping lift you up and you in turn lifting them up is really, really important. But I also want to say that it's really hard to move the needle on sales. It's one of the hardest things. And sometimes it seems like you're doing everything that you possibly can and nothing is really doing anything. And it's hard. It's just hard. You know, it's hard to be the one who's responsible for marketing your book, especially when, you know, sometimes you get to be the publisher's lead title and sometimes you don't, and you're doing everything on your own. And I think the thing to remember is that hopefully, you know, for everybody listening, your writers, your illustrators, and this book, this first book, isn't necessarily, it's not going to be your last book, right? It's going to be one book in a whole career of books that you're working on. And so I guess my best advice for marketing, it's not necessarily about marketing a specific book, but also looking at the long tail of things. So if you can be consistent, if you can start posting now before your book is out, if you can start trying to build your following, you know, as on a newsletter or a blog or even on social media, even though that is harder because the algorithms change, but build it in whatever place you feel comfortable, and start small and be consistent. You know, send out your newsletter every month, post, you know, once a week or two times a week on the same day, three times a week, every day, whatever you can handle. And just be consistent about it, because these small interactions over time, these are the things that help sell books, right? You know, somebody said, I can't remember who said that there isn't a one-to-one ratio between like you getting lots of likes and then you selling that many books. And it's true. But if you are consistently interacting, if you're having these small conversations with people, if you're really genuinely speaking to people that are interested in speaking to you, I think those interactions are the things that are going to start growing your fan base, are going to start growing your sales, because you are really genuinely interacting with people. You are excited about the people that are talking to you, and they are excited about the stuff that you're putting out. And if you can keep kind of generating that that feeling and growing that small group of people that really are excited about you and the stuff that you're doing, then eventually, hopefully, that sales number will go up. And the other thing, and this obviously doesn't, it's not great for the first book, but the thing is, every book helps your other books. So when my debut came out, I had previously illustrated a book. And when my debut came out, it helped my other book that I had illustrated in sales, because people liked my book that I wrote and illustrated. And so they looked, what else has she done? So they saw the book that I illustrated and they bought that book as well. And so, you know, my next book that comes out this year in October, I'm hoping that will help, you know, A New Kind of Wild and Thread of Love, because it's just like, it's a gradual thing. People find something that they like, you know, they like your illustrations, they like your writing, and they look and they see what else you've done. So everything that you do is going to help the other things that you've done, which doesn't help you in the short term, but it is, I think, encouraging, because it means that nothing is ever too late, right? You know, you can continue to market just by creating new and better and like exciting work. And I think the other thing, Noni talked about reaching out to teachers and doing school visits and really focusing on educators. And I think that's really important because the teachers are the ones, they're putting your books in front of the students, they're integrating them into the curriculum. And that is so, so important. It really like will stick to the kids, you know, the stuff that they're doing with your book. So I think like trying to provide resources for teachers in the form of like education guides or, you know, if you're an illustrator, putting together worksheets or if you're not an illustrator, maybe partnering with your illustrator or designer to put together, you know, worksheets or things that teachers can use in their classrooms to help teach the book. I think those are really good possibilities for kind of non-traditional marketing. And you can put those on your website and, you know, tell teachers about them. I'm doing World Read Aloud Day, which is this week, it's tomorrow, well, this whole week really. And that was something that I was able to do because of, you know, another author I followed put together a list that they invited authors to submit their names and their books. And she used her platform to essentially lift up all these other authors to allow them to, or to allow teachers to then see these people and then request author visits with them. So just kind of keeping your eye out, again, this is community, right? So if you see, you know, somebody in your community might find that and see it and post it, and then you have the opportunity to do that. I think that one actually came through, it was an author that I follow, but I took a webinar with her, and that was a resource that she kind of did because of this webinar that I took. So taking webinars with other authors, this one was specifically about school visits, and I think just finding ways to get in front of teachers, in front of students, even if you're doing it for free. My book launched during this pandemic. I didn't get to go on book tour. So I've basically been trying to say yes to anybody who wants me to come. You know, I have done like longer school visits that I've been paid for, but if somebody wants me to come and do like a half hour, like read the book, Q&A, like maybe a little drawing thing, I will do that if I have the time to do it, because every interaction with a kid, with a teacher, that is another possible sale, or also just invitation for when my next book comes out to do another school visit and then get more people to know about my book. So I really, really recommend, you know, trying to connect to teachers, trying to connect to librarians, and using your community to help you find those opportunities.
I just wanted to add it also, sometimes we feel like we need to constantly promote ourselves. And it is the case that that is 100% 24/7 job. But sometimes the best way to promote yourself is through other people. You know, promote other people's books, especially in the spaces where maybe your book hasn't just come out and you feel, what do I do to fill this space? Promote your favorite authors, promote your favorite illustrators. I mean, that's the part of the community too, where your presence is there and your presence is noted, but you are amplifying and uplifting other people.
I just wanted to add one little note that Noni actually mentioned when she was talking about, which is have your website updated. For all that is holy, have your website updated. Your contact information, your author email should be on there. If you want people to know that you can do Skype virtual visits, have that information on there. Have your agent's information on there. You might receive questions about the rights and sub-rights. Have their information on there so they can be contacted. Did you do a virtual event? Have the YouTube replay link on your website so people can watch it again so they can share it. If you're doing a pre-order campaign, have that on your website. Don't make me look through your Twitter for that one tweet you did like 3 weeks ago that says, I'm doing a signed book plate. And I'm like, where is this? Now I've lost interest. It should have been on your website. If you're doing signed editions with a local bookstore, have that on your website. Like, do make it as easy as possible for people to support you. And also, you know, have a press area with your photo with a high res and information of who took the photo. If it, I know Everyone's looking at me like you're calling me out. I'm calling everybody out, y'all. You should have a short bio and not, and also a long bio. Don't make people cut down your bio for you. It's gonna be horrible. I promise you. Just have a little short bio on there. That's like 75 words to be used in press and so on, and a high res version of your cover if you have one. Anything and everything that you can think of, just have it on there as easy as possible. So again, it makes it easy for people to support you and buy your book.
And we'll link to Mia's website in the show notes so you can all see a perfect example of what this looked like. Mia actually helped me, gave me some advice on my media kit, which I just put up a couple of weeks ago. So I was late on that as well. But we'll link to that too so you can kind of see an example. And instead of building out an entire separate web page for that information, I just linked to a folder in my Google Drive and dropped everything in. And that's a lot faster and a lot easier. And people can easily go in there and download whatever they need.
If you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of one of our books goes towards supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also sign up for the Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates as well as other Musa news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox. Thanks for listening.